Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good Monday morning and happy Labor Day to you. You are listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Glad you can join us for this special Labor Day edition of the show. Coming up this hour, we'll be re-examining what work looks like in our COVID world.
And it's a labor of love, whether you're working or playing hard. We'll hear how to find that special someone or something. But to kick things off, let's revisit the Great Resignation. Millions of people are quitting their jobs amid the pandemic, and especially as life begins to return to some form of normal here in the U.S. The Labor Department reported a record 4 million people quit their jobs in April of this year, with restaurant and hospitality workers leading the way. The reasons are many: the migration to remote work, low pay, lack of benefits, and in general, the pandemic seems to have given people some space to think about their lives and decide how they want to spend it. It comes as the economy is recovering from a massive recession. Instead of workers lining up to get hired, though, it's employers who are looking for staff right now. And that puts the power back in the hands of workers. So what's driving them, some of them at least, to find out? I sat down virtually with Bridget Trainer and Marissa Jo Mays. Bridget was a flight attendant before the pandemic hit, and Marissa worked in corporate medical device sales. But in the last year, as the pandemic changed everything, they both left. I spoke with them more about why. You'll hear Bridget here first.
I had already slightly started stepping away from flying, just for my own personal reasons. But when the pandemic hit, everything just completely flipped upside down in the airline industry. We went from overcrowded flights to all of a sudden no one is flying and we don't know what the rules are. We as flight attendants had no idea what was going on because no one else really did either. The airlines had to do massive buyouts or layoffs, or, you know, they all did something slightly different just to stay afloat. And I was lucky enough that I was able to end up taking a buyout from the airline. My airline did not end up laying anybody off, fortunately. But I think it was because they allowed people to do buyouts instead.
Yeah. So tell us about that moment, like when you make the decision to leave this career, when the industry is completely up in the air, as is, you know, the world essentially. How did that feel?
Oh, it was absolutely terrifying at first. I had never done anything else in my adult life, and going from, I'd been there 14 years to, is this really what I want to do? I don't have any other training. If I leave, this is it. I can't go back anymore.
And did you know when you left what it is you were going to do next?
No, I had no idea. I had been doing online resale for about 3.5 years. So I focused on that for a little while, and then just kind of completely on accident, I was at a little wine bar that I frequented, and they mentioned they were hiring, and thought I'd give that a try, and here I am.
Yeah. I mean, so a very different career, a very different lifestyle, obviously. How does it feel? Do you feel like, you know, you made a change worth making?
Oh, absolutely. I am so much happier now than I used to be. My level of stress has gone from a 10 to a 2 on an everyday basis. So it's significantly better. And I have absolutely no doubt that I made the correct decision when I did decide to leave.
All right, so let's turn to you now for a few minutes, Marissa, and talk about your story, which is really interesting. You began in a corporate sales job, right? And this, it sounds like, was something you'd worked toward for a long time, everything you kind of thought you'd ever wanted.
Yeah, I was kind of on the support side of this company for a couple years, and this company was different from others, where you don't start out in sales, you strive to be in sales. So I finally made it. I was the youngest person. I was the only woman. So it was kind of, you know, a big deal in the company that I had achieved this. And right when I got promoted, I moved to Philadelphia to cover my region. And that is when COVID hit. So I mean, the month that I moved is the month quarantine started. So it was pretty crazy timing.
How did that change your life, your job, your role?
Yeah, I mean, it shook up everything because not only was I in a new place, this awesome city, I couldn't go out in the city. I couldn't do anything. So, of course, I'm quarantined and all I have to do is work. But all of the work was virtual and, you know, maybe 10% going into hospitals because it was medical device sales. So I was literally at home just working, going to sleep, waking up, working, going to sleep. And it just really highlighted how much I didn't enjoy the job because, you know, my life quickly turned very miserable because that's all I was doing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what led you to the moment when you decided to quit? And you, as I should say, did this in sort of dramatic fashion on TikTok.
Yeah, it was just a buildup of all of quarantine, I think. And there was just one day in the middle of the summer when I looked myself in the mirror and was like, all right, is this really what you're going to do for the next 40 years? Because if you continue down this path, you know, keep getting promotions with this company and stay in this industry, it's just a continuous climb of this ladder that, you know, leads nowhere except eventually becoming a director or a VP one day. And I wasn't happy. I was making six figures. I had an awesome apartment. I had, quote, the dream job, but I was the most unhappy I'd ever been. So I kind of just reached a point where I was like, okay, I have to make a decision now. And I'm 27. I'm young enough to kind of start over, so to speak, with my career. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to do this because everything was changing and COVID was really highlighting that you don't know what's going to happen next year and you can't really take anything for granted. So I'm like, all right, if I'm going to do this, it needs to be now. And I had a TikTok at the time that I was using kind of as a creative outlet and just talking about my life and everything I was learning at the time about, you know, mental health and living intentionally. And it occurred to me that quitting my job was me taking a step into more intentional living and making this huge decision. So I just felt the need to share it with everyone. And it ended up getting almost 3 million views, which is just insane.
Yeah, it went viral, right? I mean, what was that like?
It was insane. I'm a huge introvert. I don't like to be the center of attention. So it was very jarring. A lot of people were telling me, oh my God, you're insane. You know, hope you have fun in your unemployment. Good luck getting a job. And it's like, it just really, everyone in the comments were projecting their biggest fears about quitting and about the pandemic just onto me. So, you know, there was a lot of support, but at the same time, it was hard to deal with a lot of people's fears in the comments.
I bet. And so now you're doing TikTok kind of full time, like this is your new job as a marketing consultant. I mean, was this kind of a fluke because this video you made ended up going viral?
Yeah. So at the time I had around 40,000 followers when I made that video. So obviously getting 3 million hits on a video will give me more followers. So I think that boosted me to about 65,000. And it occurred to me, I'm like, all right, if I'm going to quit, I don't want to just pick another corporate job that I'm inevitably going to hate in six months. So like, okay, what skills do I have? What can I help people with? And it occurred to me that, okay, I'm very good at TikTok. I know how to hook people in and make them watch my videos. And there are a lot of businesses that are just starting to use TikTok for organic reach and organic marketing. And I decided to monetize that skill set. So I'm currently helping impact-driven creatives and brands and entrepreneurs capitalize on the platform. And I've only been doing it 6 months, but I would not go back to corporate, even if I was offered a really lucrative gig.
Okay, so I'm sure you're both aware that, you know, you're in good company here. Like millions of people around the country are leaving their jobs right now. They're calling it the Great Resignation. And of course, it's for various reasons, but it definitely seems like it's all tied to the pandemic. Were either of you aware of that when you quit your jobs, that like you were going to be one of many and that this would be a thing that you would be a part of? Or does it surprise either of you that this happened?
I did not realize that this was going to be a thing, that everyone was going to be kind of rethinking their lives, changing their jobs. Of course, we knew people were getting laid off, but it really caught me off guard when I heard just how many people were impacted by it and how many people chose to change their life and their career.
Yeah, at first I felt a lot of guilt because people were getting laid off and, you know, really struggling. So I felt very, you know, fortunate to be able to intentionally quit my job and have something to kind of fall back on. But now, kind of looking back at the pandemic in hindsight, well, somewhat hindsight, it's still going, but, you know, now knowing that a lot of people were quitting, it's just crazy how similar a lot of us are. And I think that the fact that we were all forced to stay at home and be faced with our feelings about our life, it just goes to show that so many people were unhappy with their jobs. And now that it's time to go back into the office, people aren't having it. And it's just crazy that it's a very similar experience for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, like, usually this is the kind of thing lots of people quitting you see happening when there are a lot of jobs out there. People can choose from anything. There's a super strong economy, but that's not the case right now. Like, employers right now, even though we just went through this, you know, big recession, are facing shortages of employees. Do you think that your expectations of what would make you happy changed? Do you think we all are just thinking about work and what that means a little differently?
Well, I went from having the glamorous dream job. I mean, I was a flight attendant. Everyone was excited to hear about that and learn what I did. And for the first few years, it was great. And then I realized as time went on, being a flight attendant's a lifestyle and it's not for me anymore. And my job got more and more corporate as time went on. And I realized more and more that I have absolutely no interest in working in a corporate field anymore. So I'm so happy to be out of that.
Yeah, it was very similar for me. I had reached my, what I thought was my kind of dream job, dream life, dream situation, making a lot of money, living somewhere cool, doing this glamorous job that everybody wants to be in, you know, medical device sales where you get paid to travel and paid to have nice dinners. And once it actually happened for me, I was like, all right, you know, when is the happiness going to sink in? When am I going to be, you know, really satisfied with my life? And it never did. So it really made me rethink, okay, what do I want in a job? What do I want my day-to-day to look like? Do I want to be jumping on these same meetings and same phone calls and talking to these rude doctors all the time? So it just made me reevaluate, okay, what is actually going to make me happy and how can I turn that into a job?
Yeah. Yeah. So then I want to end by asking you both about, you know, I guess whether or not you think this is a good thing, ultimately. Like, it sounds like for each of you, it really was. Where do you think this might take our country, our culture, in terms of our relationship with work?
I really hope that because people have had to step away from their jobs for whatever reason, that it gives them the time to reevaluate and really actually think about what would make them happy. So many people are taught and expected to just, you go to high school, you go to college, you get the degree, you search out the big paying job. And people do that because they're expected. They don't really think they have another option lots of times. Mm-hmm. And because the pandemic basically caused such a halt to all that, I think it gave people time to actually figure out what they wanted to do for once, as opposed to what was expected.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I followed that path. You go to school, you go to college, you get maybe an advanced degree, then you land the job, and people are expected to just be happy with that and grind all day at corporate and hate their boss and hate their job, but then come home and be happy. It just doesn't add up. So I think people are realizing that there is more to life than a crappy corporate job that they hate. And there are other options, especially with, you know, the internet and all of the different ways that you can make money now. I think people are starting to realize that. And I hope that it keeps going and that it forces corporations to evaluate, you know, how they treat their employees, what the work-life balance looks like, and, you know, make the lives better for people who actually do want to stay in corporate jobs.
All right. That is Marissa Jo Mays and Bridget Trainer joining us to talk about their own stories as they quit their jobs in the last year here and how it changed their lives. Marissa, Bridget, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for telling us about your own journeys in this. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Lauren, hopefully this doesn't turn into an awkward conversation between coworkers, but this next story is about how we regulate our emotions at work and how much we care or pretend to care about what a colleague is saying. Allison Gabriel is an associate professor of management and organizations at the Eller College of Management at the University of Arizona. She started looking at customer service areas where employees tend to have scripts that tell them how to respond to what a customer says. But then she realized interactions between coworkers are just as emotionally laden. And it turns out she found people who are able to empathize or try to understand where their coworker is coming from are better off in a lot of ways than those who put on a fake smile.
So across three studies, we found that there was this group of individuals we called deep actors. So there's two ways, I should preface, that you can regulate your emotions, or at least in the way we studied it. One, as you said, is this idea of surface acting, where you're just faking a good mood when you're interacting with your coworkers. And the other is deep acting, where you're actually trying to experience the positive emotions that you're showing to other people. And so for people who primarily relied on deep acting with very low levels of surface acting, not only did they report feeling better at work, so they weren't as emotionally exhausted, they didn't feel as inauthentic. They also went ahead and said that they actually received more help from their coworkers in terms of their work, but also interpersonally, they were more supported. And what's really interesting is that they also reported that they trusted their coworkers more and their performance improved.
Why do you think it is that people who really try to understand what their coworkers are saying and sort of get into their shoes a little bit, why do they seem to do better across the board seemingly than people who, you know, maybe just pretend to be polite?
So part of it, we think, has to do with the reasons why people are engaging in that behavior. So we were equally curious about the motives or the reasons why somebody would regulate their emotions. And we found that deep actors were more likely to say that they were doing this for pro-social reasons at work, because they wanted to be friendly towards other people, they believed in being courteous towards their coworkers, or they liked interacting with their coworkers, go figure. And so for individuals who endorse these pro-social reasons, they were more likely to end up in this deep actor group. And so I think some of those kind of courtesy, liking reasons for regulating their emotions are what are coming out when they actually deep act, right? They're really valuing the interactions that they're having with people in a fairly authentic manner. Versus individuals, we have this one group of people called regulators. They were deep acting and they were surface acting. So they were trying to be more positive, but still felt the need to kind of plaster on this fake smile on top of everything else. Those individuals tended to do that for more impression management reasons. And so they were really being driven by these kind of instrumental gains in the organization versus deep actors who were saying, no, you know what, I'm doing this because I value the relationships I have with people here.
Well, it seems like the deep actors are maybe more inclined to behave that way anyway, right? Whether or not they're at work.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. And I think that would be kind of an interesting next step, is to see if you are a deep actor at work. Does that mean that this is just generally how you approach all relationships?
Did you find that the people who were on the receiving end of this kind of behavior could differentiate between these deep actors, you know, people who were really invested in what their coworker was saying versus those who were just faking it till they made it?
Yeah, that's what seems to be what our data was suggesting. So all of our data was taken from the perspective of the person who was regulating their emotions, but the regulators did not report the same type of benefits. In fact, they reported receiving less help and they had less trust with their coworkers, and they had lower levels of progress on their work-related goals. And one finding that I find particularly interesting, and I think this is why this research is striking a chord with people, because you know, some people might look at this and say, well, you're suggesting that I need to act, which still seems like inauthentic. You're telling me not to be myself. We had a group of people in our studies called non-actors. These are people who said they were doing nothing. They weren't surface acting. They weren't deep acting. So you could argue that they are being their most authentic self, right? That they're just doing nothing.
Right.
And what's interesting is, first of all, those non-actors and deep actors reported the same well-being benefits. So that's good news. So if you do nothing, you tend to feel okay. And that's a good thing. But what's interesting is that only deep actors reported any of these help or support or performance related benefits. Non-actors did not. And so it certainly seems like coworkers are crediting deep actors for the effort and kind of the energy they are putting into having these positive interactions.
So I have to say that when reading through the research that you and your colleagues did, the first thing that came to my mind were those scenes from The Office, not surprisingly. Mm-hmm. The Office would creep into my mind here, where somebody would say something or do something, and the camera would very quickly cut to a coworker kind of making a weird face like, can you believe they just did that? Or mm-hmm. I don't really have any idea what they're talking about. Or, you know, one of these things where it seems pretty clear that they're either not acting, they're being right. their authentic selves, or it seemed very surface level where they're sort of putting on a face to, you know, get some kind of reaction. I wonder right. if that was sort of in your mind at all while you were doing this research or compiling the results.
Yeah, I think that's what I find really interesting, like I said, about coworker interactions and studying how we regulate our emotions, because everybody can think of a time where they've been in a meeting and they have themselves been just feeling frustrated or fatigued, or somebody says something and they're like, oh, like, I don't know how to respond to that. And so I think that's what was one of the initial conversations we had around this was, well, do people try to cover that up? You know, are there people who only cover it up with this surface acting? We didn't find any groups of individuals who said that's all they did. And so to me, I think that is part of it, is realizing that there are going to be instances at work where you might feel things that just are socially not normative to express. And so how do you make decisions or how do you choose to regulate in response to that is pretty interesting to me.
So I have to ask, you work in an office, I work in an office.
Sure.
Have you noticed anything different about your coworkers? Like, have your interactions with coworkers been any different since you've started doing this research?
I don't know if they've been different. I've actually been told that I'm not good at doing this.
Apparently,
somebody said something once in a meeting, and I made a very strong facial reaction to that. So I was like, oh, that is interesting. Maybe I need to work on this. Or maybe, you know, the joke in academic research is that you study the things that you yourself are not good at or that you're not successful at. So I was like, oh, that's really funny that I spent a lot of time focusing on how people regulate and manage outward impression. And somebody came after and they were like, that was funny. When so-and-so said this, you looked really upset. And it's like, oh, shoot. That wasn't the goal. But I do think it is, you know, I'm fortunate where I work somewhere where we're a tight-knit community. And so I think all of our interactions tend to be really authentic and positive. But I think that in itself lends another question of, you know, how does this work in departments where there are more fractions, for instance, or, you know, different fault lines that might divide people up? So, yeah, maybe I'm not good at it. So I guess that's my own kind of research question down the road.
All right. That is Allison Gabriel, an associate professor of management and organizations at the Eller College of Management at the University of Arizona. Allison, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you are listening to The Show. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5. Thanks for listening on this Labor Day Monday.
We are revisiting some of our favorite stories that involve a little bit of work.
I turn on my computer. I go online.
Welcome. Welcome.
And my breath catches in my chest until I hear three little words.
You got mail.
In 1998, when Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks starred in the hit romantic comedy You've Got Mail, the idea of meeting someone online was a novelty. But today, oh, how the tables have turned, Mark.
Indeed. The newest research shows meeting online has become the most popular way couples meet, eclipsing even meeting through friends.
So what used to be a semi-embarrassing admission of, we met online, is now the norm.
So today on the show, we're going to dive into what this monumental shift means, what's good about it, and what's maybe not so good.
We begin by hearing from a few people who have been there. Caitlin Chapman is 22 years old. She grew up in a world where meeting someone online, or more accurately, on an app, was the norm.
The only online dating that I ever got into was just like on an app. And I've been using those for like 4 or 5 years. When I first started college is when I started using them. So you're like out of your hometown. You're like, oh, who's out here?
She met her current boyfriend on Tinder, and she sees a lot of benefits in this way of dating. Allie Mahoney, on the other hand, is 54 and has tried her hand at online dating since the beginning.
If we were to grade online dating, I'd probably be considered an online dating failure. But every time it kind of, the way it was being done shifted all the way back to where it was like AOL chat rooms, mm-hmm. to then like setting up match.com profiles, to then like it got modified a little bit, like with like the Plenty of Fish type of profiles. And then now I've done a little of the swipe right, swipe left stuff.
She remembers when it wasn't so accepted.
Yeah, back in the day, it was definitely like you as a person felt like it would seem desperate, or, you know, it just wasn't accepted. People were always worried about, well, you know, you're talking to a stranger and you're putting yourself in danger and this and that. But I think people eventually got smart with how they were handling it. But then I have several friends that met through online dating and dated successfully, married with kids. So I think as those type of situations started coming out of online dating, it became more acceptable. And as people heard about it more, it was less like a dirty secret.
Okay, so let's talk pros and cons here. Like, you hear a lot of, you know, online dating horror stories and really, you know, awkward ones. But have you also experienced some sort of freedom in this, or has it empowered you in any way, either of you?
I mean, I would say definitely, I agree with both. I think there's always, you're always running the risk of, like, you have no idea how this person really is, like their profile looks different than how they are in person and things like that. And I've definitely been on some like really, really awful dates. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's really freeing to be able to decide. You know, there's no face-to-face until you agree there's face-to-face. Like there's no, I want to say there's no added pressure to meeting someone new, because it's like you either click and you decide to meet up and you're like, oh, this is great, it's going to be fantastic. Or you send a couple messages, you don't click for whatever reason, and you want to be done with them, and you're done with them.
Yeah, I think that it also, because it's so readily available and you can just, you swipe, like you could be passing up something really good, or, you know, it just makes it seem like there's just this abundance.
Yeah.
If it was that, if there was just an abundance of people in the world, you'd find your soulmate a lot sooner, you know? So you just, sometimes I think you can get a little, take advantage of the fact that there's an abundance, and it's probably not really an abundance.
What about you, Caitlin? Like, coming from a generation that is, you know, almost entirely in relationships this way, do you think that there's something you're missing out on? Like, do you wish that you could meet the way your grandparents met, or like in some sort of meet cute romantic comedy way?
I feel like I'm too much the pessimist to ever agree with that. I love that. Tinder especially, you have to link your Facebook. So like anyone that you match with, you know they at least have a Facebook. And I would do that with every person I would meet up with. Because when you've created a profile for dating, you're trying to showcase like the best parts of yourself, and you get to pick and choose what those are. But like nobody thinks that much about what they post on Facebook. Like when you find someone on social media, that's like the stuff they really care about and like the things that they want to share with the world. Mm. So I think that's always great.
So to you and to people your age, it sounds like you really think that what somebody posts online is authentic.
In my experience, most guys don't care about their social media as much as girls do. So like,
oh, absolutely.
If the guy's going to take the time to post it, he cares about it to some degree. But yeah, I think it's great that we can look them up, especially as a young then single woman in the city. Like, I think it's a form of protection even. It's not even just like, I need to know everything about you because I'm curious. It's like, are you going to hurt me if I meet up with you somewhere?
Right. Yeah. So this really is a huge shift in our society and how we meet people and how we form romantic relationships and then therefore families, et cetera. Do either of you think that this is fundamentally going to change things in terms of the way that we interact with one another?
Yes and no. I feel like it just kind of goes along with what being social has turned into now, with like how we all interact on social media. Like, I'm sure I interact with my friends on social media far more often than I ever get to see them in person.
So do you feel like there's any sort of loss of community or of being able to talk to somebody and meet somebody face to face?
I don't think there is. I think all of the things that make a community have translated well online, and I'm sure it was a little bumpy at first as everyone's like navigating like, oh, you need to be on these platforms if you want to talk about these things. But I think people have adapted to that. And I think that sense of community is online, too.
Allie?
I think that what it might affect long term and maybe even in the short term is, are people getting married at a later age now? Because it feels a little, I don't want to say throwaway, but that's just what it comes to mind, more of like a throwaway thinking that not investing in someone because it's easy to just pick up the phone and like look for the next someone.
So I'll end on a positive question then. So if we're talking about, you know, big shifts that this represents for our society, do you think there are some net positive ones too? Like, do you think that this really can open up doors that weren't open before?
I think generally it's a positive. I mean, giving yourself that little buffer at the beginning to like lay it all out and be like, this is exactly what I'm looking for. Like, this is how much commitment I'm putting into this. What are you doing so that nobody is disappointed? Ideally.
That is online daters Caitlin Chapman and Allie Mahoney. So now let's turn to an expert. Alex Halavay is a social media researcher and associate professor of critical data studies at ASU and an occasional guest on the show. He says, as with all things in the social media realm, there's good here and there's bad. But we began our conversation with demographics. This new research is about heterosexual couples. But what about everybody else?
It has shifted for heterosexual couples. That's the largest marriage and dating market. There are, at the margins, folks who have engaged in various forms of dating outside of the mainstream dating, and that includes LGBT folks who had a smaller marriage market, and so it's not necessarily obvious when you meet someone whether they're gay or not, and being able to move online allowed to break down some of those initial questions.
So the sense is that we used to rely on our friends and family and our social networks in a not virtual way.
Right.
to introduce us to the person that we'd end up marrying or dating. And now this has been replaced by algorithms, by
right.
robots, for lack of a better phrase. So I will ask you right off the bat, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing?
Yes. The answer for that question is always yes.
Yes.
There's probably a parallel here, right? Because we used to shop in mom and pop shops and they would decide for you what cereals were probably good. And then we moved to supermarkets and now we're on Amazon where you can get pretty much anything on the planet and decide the exact breakfast cereal that is matched to you. So I mean, I think if we consider it along those lines, the sort of dating market, if we want to call it that, has followed the traditional market. Hmm. So it's kind of moved over time. I mean, the real advantage is that we can kind of innovate and evolve and find people that we would never have found before. But it's true that we are going to lose something in that process.
What is it that you lose?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to quantify, right?
Yeah.
These are very quantified markets. They're using algorithms and quantified algorithms to figure out what matches. So it's really hard to say offhand what that ephemeral missing bit is. Some of it is spontaneity. Some of it is an assumption that we get along better with people who share sometimes superficial choices and styles. Some of it may be that people who would have done better in an offline environment are losing out to those who present themselves better in an online environment. This is maybe a Revenge of the Nerds scenario where those of us who can kind of present ourselves in public online better than offline do better. But there is something that maybe ephemeral is missing there, some level of trust, maybe some embeddedness in social networks.
How successful are these algorithms then at pairing us up?
I think they do a pretty good job. And it's not so much where they are now. This is kind of the same thing with self-driving cars. It's that they seem to be able to improve.
Hmm.
So, you know, your mom is not going to improve in setting you up with blind dates. It's just not going to happen. Sorry, Mom. I don't trust my mom on movie recommendations. But movie recommending systems didn't work very well before, and now they work better than any human can. And so I think its infinite improvability, at least among those who design these systems, is what makes it enticing.
So what's good about it? Like, you mentioned this idea that, like, we can now meet people we would definitely not have met otherwise. I have a friend who just met someone online who doesn't live in the city, and now, you know, they're dating and visiting each other every month, and it's great. And that obviously wouldn't have happened otherwise. What other doors does this open?
I think that's the big one, right? That you open up a market of people that you wouldn't otherwise run into. So there are a couple of pieces of this. One is that if you have very particular interests or wants, you're not restricted to those within your very small community. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we found across the board. At the same time, it may mean that we narrow our choices, that we find people that have very similar views, both about the way the world works and about the kinds of things they like.
So I wonder then, this leads me to a broader question about community. And I think you and I have talked about this on the show before, is like if all of our groceries are delivered and we don't go to the grocery store and have to bump into anybody, what are the losses there? Like, are we losing any physical community spaces where these things could happen, where you might meet somebody?
Yeah, I mean, we're changing it for sure. Mm-hmm. And so some of this is that people still go out on dates. They still meet people in person. And so when this facilitates that, you could say that there's spaces here for creating new kinds of community. And in fact, some of my students have talked a lot about that. They really want a Tinder for going out and seeing a concert. You know, like they want this to help them find a friend group, not just potentially partners. Wow. And so there is a thirst for that. And I think that it is missing. I think there's another problem here, which is we don't know how these algorithms work. And so we've handed a big piece of our social process over to corporations who then control who we can see. And we don't know how that works. And in some cases, even the corporations aren't quite sure how the algorithms are making those matches. And so handing such a big piece of our communities and our social lives over to a company that has a profit motive and very little oversight is frightening.
All right. That's Alex Halavay, a social media researcher and associate professor of critical data studies at ASU. Alex, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to The Show. Good morning. You're listening to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Today, we are revisiting a handful of stories that have their work cut out for them. And one of those has to do with sports. Last year, the coronavirus upended how games function. Various strategies were implemented, including keeping players in quote-unquote bubbles and playing to empty stadiums.
This year saw a cautious return to some normalcy, with teams allowing small numbers of fans to come to the games. As vaccination rates went up and before the Delta variant became dominant, some stadiums even allowed full capacity.
The coronavirus also shoved aside some of the issues that plague sports teams. Authors Jessica Luther and Kavitha Davidson write about the complications between fans and players and the broader culture in their new book, Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back.
Our co-host Steve Goldstein spoke with Luther and Davidson. He began by asking Luther whether she, as a female sports journalist, still faces the stereotypical criticism from people who don't believe she understands sports.
Yeah, absolutely. All the time. I feel very defensive. Like if I'm in a casual social setting and it comes up that I am a sports writer, I get nervous. Like I have my hackle, you know, like the hairs on my neck go up in worry that I'm going to be asked, I'm going to be quizzed on the spot about my sports knowledge. I feel like as women in the sports world, we are just so used to people we work with, our colleagues, but also fans of sport, assuming that we aren't actually knowledgeable about the thing that we spend most of our time learning about and writing about.
And Kavitha?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the impetus for us writing this book was Jessica and I being sick of, you know, those condescending posts that usually come up around the Super Bowl that are clearly geared to women and women who don't know anything about sports. And, you know, those posts that are like how to talk to your boyfriend about football or how to throw a Super Bowl party and, you know, fake it through the game. And we were just so tired of it. You know, like it's very clear that so much of sports media is not geared toward us or toward fans who look like us. But even just as Jessica said, in a casual social setting, you know, it's really easy to be made to feel like you're the unicorn in the room, right? Like you're some like outlier, like magical, mythical female sports fan. And it is a little bit ridiculous. And like you said, even as people continue to evolve, it's still one of, you know, the most pervasive parts of this industry is just how irregular it seems to be to people that women can be sports fans.
Much, if not all, the book was written before the pandemic. And now we're seeing, of course, how players are dealing with there not being any fans. We had a moment of unity in the first NFL game of the season. And yet the sparse crowd that was allowed in the stadium actually booed this. I mean, not everyone certainly, but there were enough boos to be heard. Jessica, let me ask you about this. Is this one of the things that the average sports fan or a sports fan who wants to be socially conscious still has to deal with? That it's still the whole stick to sports phrase is still out there among some fans?
Yeah, all the time. That's funny. The moment of unity when it clearly was not a moment of unity because you could hear the booing,
right.
Which was so interesting to think about what exactly it was that people were booing in that moment. But yeah, I think stick to sports is a really pervasive idea, which is false, right? Like the entire point of the book is that all of these things that people consider political, whether or not they are deeply embedded. They're in the system of sports. And for those people who deal with those things all the time in their lives, they're just as much there in sports. They see them all the time, right? That you're only certain people who have the pleasure of not having to think about these things when they turn to sports. And we really wanted to use this book to address those things, both for those people who don't have to deal with them, who get to stick to sports, and we feel those people are very, very lucky, but also for those of us who can't do that, that they feel seen, that there are others like them who love sports but don't feel like sports love them back.
Is there a feeling that more fans actually want to stick to sports, or is that contradictory to what you see and what you experience?
I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like, I clearly live in a bubble where I, like, my fan experience and the experience of me and my friends and the people I know is probably not indicative of, you know, broader trends in the country. But I mean, I think that stick to sports is just, it's a privilege that so few of us actually have, right? Like, I mean, the identities that you have to occupy to be able to ignore everything that's going on in the world are shrinking and frankly already very limited. So one of the things that we're seeing, especially with athlete activism in the NBA and the WNBA, is that these players are human beings, and they're forcing people to recognize that they can't just ignore that they are Black men and women in America. And similarly, you know, a lot of us who are sports fans, whether we're Black or white or gay or straight or whatever, you know, it's not possible for some of us to just ignore the bad or the ills or the ways in which sports are reflecting some of the things that are going wrong in broader society. So, I mean, I do think that, you know, the number of people who are actually capable of sticking to sports is fewer than the rest of us, but they happen to also be extremely loud. And, you know, the people who run sports media companies tend to listen to those people.
Jessica, as a woman who obviously is an accomplished sports writer and also someone who's loved sports your whole life, is there a situation that it comes down to, it could be friends, could be acquaintances, that may express frustration with you? These are ones who believe that you are terrific at your job, that you know what you're doing, that you're not being talked down to. When you are socially conscious of these things, are expectations higher for fans like that? Because it's like, well, wait a second, you guys can see that they're doing these wrong things, and yet you still want to just love what's going on the field. Is that a tough thing to deal with sometimes? Is that sort of fan?
Yeah, I think so. That's a really great question. I think that I do feel this need to be on the right side of things sometimes, because I clearly care and I'm conscious and conscientious about all of these things. So I do feel a pressure to be aware and to show my awareness. I mean, one thing that I talk about is at the beginning of the WNBA wobble, when they started play again, I really didn't know whether or not to be public, like to tweet that I was actually watching the games, because I felt very conflicted personally about whether or not they should even be playing. I didn't want them to be playing. I still feel very strange about the fact that sports are happening in the middle of everything else. But I was watching and I did enjoy it. And I was like, oh gosh, if I tweet that I'm enjoying the WNBA on television, does that look like I don't care about what's happening with COVID? But if I don't tweet, does that mean I'm not showing support for these women who I clearly think deserve way more attention and resource and time than they're getting? And I feel these moral dilemmas just in my everyday life. That was just the most recent example of it.
Kavitha, I presume you have a similar experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I similarly didn't know how to handle sports coming back. I didn't think it was responsible. I'm glad that the bubble systems have seemed to have worked, starting with the NWSL and then obviously with the NBA and the WNBA. But at the same time, you know, I'm from New York City, and I have so many friends who at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, New York really felt like we were on an island. We were going through this thing that the rest of the country was not going through to the same level. And I have so many friends who, now that, you know, New York is kind of on the other side of it, at least for this wave, who said, you know, I don't know if it's responsible for sports to come back, but I just want some sense of normalcy. I want some kind of distraction. I'm tired of the sirens every hour. And I don't know how to argue with that, right? That's such a human and understandable response. So, I mean, that's just, this pandemic has kind of heightened how all of these dilemmas exist within us and how hard it is to reconcile them. But yeah, I mean, I definitely personally go through those dilemmas all the time.
That is Kavitha Davidson. She and Jessica Luther are the co-authors of the new book, Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back. Thank you so much for the time today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the show.
Welcome back to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. Thanks for listening on this Labor Day Monday. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. For the end of this Labor Day special, I got a story that will get your heart working.
Lauren, you're not going to make me run on a treadmill or something while we read this, are you?
No, but that would be fun.
For you, maybe, yes.
This is more tied to how our brains can manipulate our emotions. Last year, the iconic summer blockbuster Jaws turned 45, and so did the movie's iconic score. You know those two famous notes of the Jaws theme?
Yeah, you mean the ba-dum? That gives me the creeps every time.
Yes, it does. It's amazing how just those two notes have become so iconic and can trigger goosebumps on all of us. So this got us wondering, why does music have such an emotional effect on us? For more on that, I got a hold of Don Trout, a professor of theory at the University of Arizona's Fred Fox School of Music.
There are several things about the opening of Jaws that trigger things in our brains that sort of connect to our flight or fight instinct, that kind of lizard brain thing that you hear about from time to time. The first of these is that it's low and it's soft and it's mysterious. There's not a lot of notes at the beginning, right? It's not even really a melody at first. It's just one note and then it stops. And then there's two notes and then it stops again. And so these long pauses with no pulse attached to them that we can latch onto at first really create this sense of mystery and the unknown. And our brain really prefers patterns to lock into something that it can build expectations from. Eventually it does lock in and you have this pulsating, it's seemingly speeding up of that kind of back and forth between those two notes. So we do finally get this pulse, but it's speeding up, and then eventually we start to get these dissonant, harsh, and aggressive brass sounds that are given to us at unpredictable intervals. So it's another case where it's not a predictable pattern that is helping us know what to expect. It's still giving us these irregularly spaced, short and stabbing kind of dissonant, harsh brass sounds. And it eventually builds and builds and gets our pulse racing.
Okay, so another film score we want to talk about is the really famous one for the shower scene in Psycho, right?
Yes, yeah.
This is not dissimilar from what we hear in Jaws for some of these same reasons, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that's right. The shower scene in Psycho is composed by Bernard Herrmann, and it's a little bit different because in Jaws we have something that's low and soft and then builds up. And in the shower scene from Psycho, we get these really harsh and unpleasant, kind of almost screeching sounds in the violins. They're really harsh sounding. And that kind of harsh sound also triggers an alertness in our psyche.
Okay, so let's spend the last few minutes of this interview talking about the other end of the scale, the less scary and sad side of it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, give us a few examples of composers. You're an expert in classical music, I know, like that do this the other way around, that mm-hmm. bring us music that really makes us happy in a way mm-hmm. that we can't quite explain.
Mm-hmm. The one that comes to mind most readily for most people when we think of happy classical music is probably Mozart. We have the image of Mozart as a child, both playing and composing music. And really throughout his life, he was able to capture that sort of playful and happy type of music with the great melodies that he wrote. There's a piano sonata in C major that is quite famous, and it simply starts off by arpeggiating that major triad. And then playing the scale, but also there's just a sort of simple and steady rhythm that goes along with it. And it's, you know, it's predictable and it's familiar, but it's, you know, it's just very good. More recent examples would be Randy Newman. I like Randy Newman a lot. Mm-hmm. He's been a songwriter for a long time, but more recently he's written the music for all the Toy Story movies.
Yeah,
for example.
I know this so, well. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you think of the song "You've Got a Friend in Me," that's definitely in a major key and is, you know, just a happy tune.
You've got a friend in me when the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed.
And pop music does this for us a lot, right? Like it's popular because it gives us all these things.
Exactly right. Yeah. I might be showing my age, but there's a song called "Walking on Sunshine" by Katrina and the Waves from back in the 80s that is just a really happy, you know, three chords, and they're all just major chords and a nice poppy beat to it. All of those things help us feel happy. So.
Yeah. All right. That is Don Trout, an associate professor of music theory at the University of Arizona's Fred Fox School of Music. Don, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this.
Thank you so much, Lauren. It's been a pleasure.
All right. On that note, I think it's time to wrap up the special Labor Day show. What do you think?
I get the joke there. Yes, it is time. That's it for our Labor Day show. We hope you enjoy the rest of your holiday. We will be back with the latest news and analysis tomorrow, starting at 9 a.m.
The show is produced by Kaylee Monahan and Rich Copeland, as well as Bruce Drummond and T.R. Vian. Sky Shout is our digital editor. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great rest of your day.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Steve Goldstein. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, thanks for listening today.